When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 6 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P.G. Wodehouse. Chapter 6. The Hero's Reward. I don't know if you've noticed it, but it's rummy how nothing in this world ever seems to be absolutely perfect. The drawback to this otherwise singularly fruity binge was, of course, the fact that Jeeves wouldn't be on the spot to watch me in action. Still, apart from that, there wasn't a flaw. The beauty of the thing was, you see, that nothing could possibly go wrong. You know how it is, as a rule, when you want to get Chappie A on spot B at exactly the same moment when Chappie C is on spot D. There's always a chance of a hitch. Take the case of a general, I mean to say, who's planning out a big movement. He tells one regiment to capture the hill with the windmill on it at the exact moment when another regiment is taking the bridgehead, or something, down in the valley. And everything gets all messed up. And then, when they're chatting the thing over in camp that night, the colonel of the first regiment says, "Oh, sorry, did you say the hill with the windmill? I thought you said the one with the flock of sheep." And there you are. But in this case, nothing like that could happen, because Oswald and Bingo would be on the spot right along, so that all I had to worry about was getting Honoria there in due season. And I managed that all right first shot, by asking her if she would come for a stroll in the grounds with me, as I had something particular to say to her. She had arrived shortly after lunch in the car with the Braithwaite girl. I was introduced to the latter, a tallish girl with blue eyes and fair hair. I rather took to her. She was so unlike Honoria, and if I had been able to spare the time, I shouldn't have minded talking to her for a bit. But business was business. I had fixed it up with Bingo to be behind the bushes at 3 sharp, so I got hold of Honoria and steered her out through the grounds in the direction of the lake. "You're very quiet, Mr. Wooster," she said. Made me jump a bit. I was concentrating pretty tensely at the moment. We had just come in sight of the lake, and I was casting a keen eye over the ground to see that everything was in order. Everything appeared to be as arranged. The kid Oswald was hunched up on the bridge, and as Bingo wasn't visible, I took it that he had got into position. My watch made it 2 minutes after the hour. "Eh?" I said. "Oh, ah, yes. I was just thinking." "You said you had something important to say to me." "Absolutely." I had decided to open the proceedings by sort of paving the way for young Bingo. I mean to say, without actually mentioning his name, I wanted to prepare the girl's mind for the fact that, surprising as it might seem, there was someone who had long loved her from afar and all that sort of rot. "It's like this," I said. "It may sound rummy and all that, but there's somebody who's frightfully in love with you and so forth. A friend of mine, you know."
"Oh, a friend of yours?"
"Yes." She gave a kind of a laugh.
"Well, why doesn't he tell me so?"
"Well, you see, that's the sort of chap he is. Kind of shrinking, diffident kind of fellow. Hasn't got the nerve. Thinks you so much above him, don't you know? Looks on you as a sort of goddess. Worships the ground you tread on, but can't whack up the ginger to tell you so."
"This is very interesting."
"Yes, he's not a bad chap, you know, in his way. Rather an ass, perhaps, but well-meaning. Well, that's the posish. You might just bear it in mind, what?"
"How funny you are!"
She chucked back her head and laughed with considerable vim. She had a penetrating sort of laugh, rather like a train going into a tunnel. It didn't sound over-musical to me, and on the kid Oswald it appeared to jar not a little. He gazed at us with a good deal of dislike.
"I wish the dickens you wouldn't make that row," he said, "scaring all the fish away."
It broke the spell a bit. Honoria changed the subject.
"I do wish Oswald wouldn't sit on the bridge like that," she said. "I'm sure it isn't safe. He might easily fall in."
"I'll go and tell him," I said.
I suppose the distance between the kid and me at this juncture was about 5 yards, and I got the impression that it was nearer 100. And as I started to toddle across the intervening space, I had a rummy feeling that I'd done this very thing before. Then I remembered. Years ago, at a country house party, I had been roped in to play the part of a butler in some amateur theatricals in aid of some ghastly charity or other, and I had to open the proceedings by walking across the empty stage from left upper entrance and shoving a tray on a table down right. They had impressed it on me at rehearsals that I mustn't take the course at a quick heel and toe, like a chappie finishing strongly in a walking race, and the result was that I kept the brakes on to such an extent that it seemed to me as if I was never going to get to the bally table at all. The stage seemed to stretch out in front of me like a trackless desert, and there was a kind of breathless hush as if all nature had paused to concentrate its attention on me personally. Well, I felt just like that now. I had a kind of dry gulping in my throat, and the more I walked, the farther away the kid seemed to get, till suddenly I found myself standing just behind him without quite knowing how I'd got there. "Hello," I said, with a sickly sort of grin, wasted on the kid because he didn't bother to turn round and look at me. He merely wiggled his left ear in a rather peevish manner. I don't know when I've met anybody in whose life I appear to mean so little. "Hello," I said. "Fishing?" I laid my hand in a sort of elderly brotherly way on his shoulder. "Here, look out," said the kid, wobbling on his foundations. It was one of those things that want doing quickly or not at all. I shut my eyes and pushed. Something seemed to give. There was a scrambling sound, a kind of yelp, a scream in the offing, and a splash. And so the long day wore on, so to speak. I opened my eyes. The kid was just coming to the surface. "Help!" I shouted, cocking an eye on the bush from which young Bingo was scheduled to emerge. Nothing happened. Young Bingo didn't emerge to the slightest extent whatever. "I say, help!" I shouted again. I don't want to bore you with reminiscences of my theatrical career, but I must just touch once more on that appearance of mine as the butler. The scheme on that occasion had been that when I put the tray on the table, the heroine would come on and say a few words to get me off. Well, on the night the misguided female forgot to stand by, and it was a full minute before the search party located her and shot her onto the stage. And all the time I had to stand there waiting. A rotten sensation, believe me, and this was just the same, only worse. I understood what these writer chappies mean when they talk about time standing still. Meanwhile, the kid Oswald was presumably being cut off in his prime, and it began to seem to me that some sort of steps ought to be taken about it. What I had seen of the lad hadn't particularly endeared him to me, but it was undoubtedly a bit thick to let him pass away. I don't know when I've seen anything more grubby and unpleasant than the lake as viewed from the bridge, but the thing apparently had to be done. I chucked off my coat and vaulted over. It seems rummy that water should be so much wetter when you go into it with your clothes on than when you're just bathing, but take it from me that it is. I was only under about 3 seconds, I suppose, but I came up feeling like the bodies you read of in the paper, which had evidently been in the water several days. I felt clammy and bloated. At this point, the scenario struck another snag. I had assumed that directly I came to the surface, I should get hold of the kid and steer him courageously to shore. But he hadn't waited to be steered. When I had finished getting the water out of my eyes and had time to take a look round, I saw him about 10 yards away, going strongly and using, I think, the Australian crawl. The spectacle took all the heart out of me. I mean to say, the whole essence of a rescue, if you know what I mean, is that the party of the second part shall keep fairly still and in one spot. If he starts swimming off on his own account and can obviously give you at least 40 yards in the 100, where are you? The whole thing falls through. It didn't seem to me that there was much to be done except get ashore, so I got ashore. By the time I had landed, the kid was halfway to the house. Look at it from whatever angle you like, the thing was a washout. I was interrupted in my meditations by a noise like the Scotch Express going under a bridge. It was Honoria Glossop laughing. she was standing at my elbow, looking at me in a rummy manner.
"Oh, Bertie, you are funny," she said.
And even in that moment there seemed to me something sinister in the words. She had never called me anything except Mr. Wooster before.
"How wet you are!"
"Yes, I am wet." "You had better hurry into the house and change."
"Yes."
I wrung a gallon or two of water out of my clothes.
"You are funny," she said again. "First proposing in that extraordinarily roundabout way, and then pushing poor little Oswald into the lake so as to impress me by saving him."
I managed to get the water out of my throat sufficiently to try to correct this fearful impression.
"No, no. He said you pushed him in, and I saw you do it. Oh, I'm not angry, Bertie. I think it was too sweet of you. But I'm quite sure it's time that I took you in hand. You certainly want someone to look after you. You've been seeing too many moving pictures.
I suppose the next thing you would have done would have been to set the house on fire as to rescue me." She looked at me in a proprietary sort of way.
"I think," she said, "I shall be able to make something of you, Bertie. It is true yours has been a wasted life up to the present, but you are still young, and there is a lot of good in you."
"No, really, there isn't."
"Oh, yes, there is. It simply wants bringing out. You run straight up to the house and change your wet clothes, or you'll catch cold."
And, if you know what I mean, there was a sort of motherly note in her voice which seemed to tell me, even more than her actual words, that I was for it. As I was coming downstairs after changing, I ran into young Bingo, looking festive to a degree.
"Bertie," he said, "just the man I wanted to see. Bertie, a wonderful thing has happened."
"You blighter," I cried, "what became of you? Do you know?
Oh, you mean about being in those bushes? I hadn't time to tell you about that. It's all off."
"All off?" "Bertie, I was actually starting to hide in those bushes when the most extraordinary thing happened. Walking across the lawn, I saw the most radiant, the most beautiful girl in the world. There is none like her, none. Bertie, do you believe in love at first sight?"
"You do believe in love at first sight, don't you, Bertie, old man? Directly I saw her, she seemed to draw me like a magnet. I seemed to forget everything. We two were alone in a world of music and sunshine. I joined her. I got into conversation. She is a Miss Braithwaite, Bertie, Daphne Braithwaite. Directly our eyes met, I realized that what I had imagined to be my love for Honoria Glossop had been a mere passing whim. Bertie, you do believe in love at first sight, don't you? She is so wonderful, so sympathetic, like a tender goddess." At this point, I left the blighter.
2 days later, I got a letter from Jeeves. "The weather," it ended, "continues fine. I have had one exceedingly enjoyable bathe." I gave one of those hollow, mirthless laughs and went downstairs to join Honoria. I had an appointment with her in the drawing-room. She was going to read Ruskin to me. End of chapter 6. Chapter 7 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P. G. Woodhouse. Chapter 7. Introducing Claude and Eustace. The blow fell precisely at 1:45 summertime. Spencer, Aunt Agatha's butler, was offering me the fried potatoes at the moment, and such was my emotion that I lofted 6 of them onto the sideboard with the spoon. Shaken to the core, if you know what I mean. Mark you, I was in a pretty enfeebled condition already. I had been engaged to Honoria Glossop nearly 2 weeks, and during all that time not a day had passed without her putting in some heavy work in the direction of what Aunt Agatha had called molding me. I had read solid literature till my eyes bubbled. We had legged it together through miles of picture galleries. I had been compelled to undergo classic concerts to an extent you would hardly believe. All in all, therefore, I was in no fit state to receive shocks, especially shocks like this. Honoria had lugged me round to lunch at Aunt Agatha's, and I had just been saying to myself, "Death, where is thy jolly old sting?"
when she hove the bomb.
"Bertie," she said suddenly, as if she had just remembered it, "what is the name of that man of yours, your valet?"
"Eh? Oh, Jeeves."
"I think he's a bad influence for you," said Honoria. "When we are married, you must get rid of Jeeves." It was at this point that I jerked the spoon and sent six of the best and crispest sailing onto the sideboard, with Spencer gambolling after them like a dignified old retriever.
"Get rid of Jeeves?" I gasped.
"Yes, I don't like him."
"I don't like him," said Aunt Agatha.
"But I can't. I mean, why, I couldn't carry on for a day without Jeeves."
"You will have to," said Honoria.
"I don't like him at all."
"I don't like him at all," said Aunt Agatha. "I never did."
Ghastly, what? I'd always had an idea that marriage was a bit of a washout, but I'd never dreamed that it demanded such frightful sacrifices from a fellow. I passed the rest of the meal in a sort of stupor. The scheme had been, if I remember, that after lunch I should go off and caddy for Honoria at a shopping tour down Regent Street. But when she got up and started collecting me and the rest of her things, Aunt Agatha stopped her.
"You run along, dear," she said. "I want to say a few words to Bertie."
So Honoria legged it, and Aunt Agatha drew up her chair and started in.
"Bertie," she said, "dear Honoria does not know it, but a little difficulty has arisen about your marriage."
"By Jove, not really," I said, hope starting to dawn.
"Oh, it's nothing at all, of course. It is only a little exasperating. The fact is, Sir Roderick is being rather troublesome.
Thinks I'm not a good bet? Wants to scratch the fixture? Well, perhaps he's right. Pray do not be so absurd, Bertie. It is nothing so serious as that.
But the nature of Sir Roderick's profession unfortunately makes him over-cautious."
I didn't get it.
"Over-cautious?"
"Yes. I suppose it's inevitable. A nerve specialist with his extensive practice can hardly help taking a rather warped view of humanity."
I got what she was driving at now. Sir Roderick Glossop, Honoria's father, is always called a nerve specialist because it sounds better. But everybody knows that he's really a sort of janitor to the loony bin. I mean to say, when your uncle the Duke begins to feel the strain a bit, and you find him in the blue drawing-room sticking straws in his hair, old Glossop is the first person you send for. He toddles round, gives the patient the once-over, talks about overexcited nervous systems, and recommends complete rest and seclusion and all that sort of thing. Practically every posh family in the country has called him in at one time or another, and I suppose that, being in that position, I mean constantly having to sit on people's heads while their nearest and dearest phone to the asylum to send round the wagon, does tend to make a chappie take what you might call a warped view of humanity."
"You mean he thinks I may be a loony, and he doesn't want a loony son-in-law?" I said. Aunt Agatha seemed rather peeved than otherwise at my ready intelligence.
"Of course he does not think anything so ridiculous. I told you he was simply exceedingly cautious. He wants to satisfy himself that you are perfectly normal." Here she paused, for Spencer had come in with the coffee. When he had gone, she went on. "He appears to have got hold of some extraordinary story about your having pushed his son Oswald into the lake at Dittridge Hall. Incredible, of course. Even you would hardly do a thing like that."
"Well, I did sort of lean against him, you know, and he shot off the bridge."
"Oswald definitely accuses you of having pushed him into the water. That has disturbed Sir Roderick, and unfortunately it has caused him to make inquiries, and he has heard about your poor Uncle Henry." She eyed me with a good deal of solemnity, and I took a grave sip of coffee. We were peeping into the family cupboard and having a look at the good old skeleton. My late Uncle Henry, you see, was by way of being the blot on the Worcester escutcheon. An extremely decent chappie personally, and one who had always endeared himself to me by tipping me with considerable lavishness when I was at school. But there's no doubt he did at times do rather rummy things, notably keeping 11 pet rabbits in his bedroom, and I suppose a purist might have considered him more or less off his onion. In fact, to be perfectly frank, he wound up his career, happy to the last and completely surrounded by rabbits in some sort of a home.
"It is very absurd, of course," continued Aunt Agatha. "If any of the family had inherited poor Henry's eccentricity, and it was nothing more, it would have been Claude and Eustace, and there could not be two brighter boys."
"Claude and Eustace were twins, and had been kids at school with me in my last summer term. Casting my mind back, it seemed to me that bright just about described them. The whole of that term, as I remembered it, had been spent in getting them out of a series of frightful rows. Look how well they are doing at Oxford. Your Aunt Emily had a letter from Claude only the other day saying that they hope to be elected shortly to a very important college club called the Seekers."
"Seekers?"
"I couldn't recall any club of the name in my time at Oxford."
"What do they seek?"
"Claude did not say. Truth or knowledge, I should imagine." "It is evidently a very desirable club to belong to, for Claude added that Lord Rainsby, the Earl of Datchet's son, was one of his fellow candidates. However, we are wandering from the point, which is that Sir Roderick wants to have a quiet talk with you quite alone. Now, I rely on you, Bertie, to be, I won't say intelligent, but at least sensible. Don't giggle nervously. Try to keep that horrible glassy expression out of your eyes. Don't yawn or fidget. And remember that Sir Roderick is the president of the West London branch of the Anti-Gambling League, so please do not talk about horse racing. He will lunch with you at your flat tomorrow at 1:30. Please remember that he drinks no wine, strongly disapproves of smoking, and can only eat the simplest food, owing to an impaired digestion. Do not offer him coffee, for he considers it the root of half the nerve trouble in the world.
I should think a dog biscuit and a glass of water would about meet the case, what?"
"Bertie!"
"Oh, all right, merely persiflage."
"Well, it is precisely that sort of idiotic remark that would be calculated to arouse Sir Roderick's worst suspicions. Do please try to refrain from any misguided flippancy when you are with him. He is a very serious-minded man. Are you going? Well, please remember all I have said. I rely on you, and if anything goes wrong, I shall never forgive you."
"Righto," I said. And so home, with a jolly day to look forward to. I breakfasted pretty late next morning and went for a stroll afterwards. It seemed to me that anything I could do to clear the old lemon ought to be done, and a bit of fresh air generally relieves that rather foggy feeling that comes over a fellow early in the day. I had taken a stroll in the park and got back as far as Hyde Park Corner, when some blighter sloshed me between the shoulder blades. It was young Eustace, my cousin. He was arm in arm with two other fellows, the one on the outside being my cousin Claude, and the one in the middle a pink-faced chappie with light hair and an apologetic sort of look.
"Bertie, old egg," said young Eustace affably.
"Hello," I said, not frightfully chirpily.
"Fancy running into you, the one man in London who can support us in the style we are accustomed to. By the way, you never met old Dogface, have you? Dogface, this is my cousin Bertie. Lord Rainsby, Mr. Wooster. We've just been round to your flat, Bertie. Bitterly disappointed that you were out, but were hospitably entertained by old Jeeves. That man's a corker, Bertie. Stick to him."
"What are you doing in London?" I asked.
"Oh, buzzing round. We're just up for the day. Flying visit, strictly unofficial. We oil back on the 3:10. And now, touching that lunch you very decently volunteered to stand us, which shall it be? Ritz, Savoy, Carlton? Or if you're a member of Ciro's or the Embassy, that would do just as well."
"I can't give you lunch. I've got an engagement myself."
"And by Jove," I said, taking a look at my watch, "I'm late."
I hailed a taxi.
"Sorry."
"As man to man, then," said Eustace, "lend us a fiver." I hadn't time to stop and argue. I unbelted the fiver and hopped into the cab. It was 20 to 2 when I got to the flat. I bounded into the sitting room, but it was empty.
Jeeves shimmied in.
"Sir Roderick has not yet arrived, sir."
"Good egg," I said. "I thought I should find him smashing up the furniture."
"My experience is that the less you want a fellow, the more punctual he's bound to be.
and I had had a vision of the old lad pacing the rug in my sitting-room, saying, "He cometh not," and generally hotting up. "Is everything in order?"
"I fancy you will find the arrangements quite satisfactory, sir."
"What are you giving us?"
"Cold consommé, a cutlet, and a savoury, sir, with lemon squash, iced."
"Well, I don't see how that can hurt him.
Don't go getting carried away by the excitement of the thing and start bringing in coffee."
"No, sir."
"And don't let your eyes get glassy, because if you do, you're apt to find yourself in a padded cell before you know where you are."
"Very good, sir."
There was a ring at the bell.
"Stand by, Jeeves," I said. "We're off."
End of chapter 7. Chapter 8 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P. G. Woodhouse. Chapter 8. Sir Roderick Comes to Lunch. I had met Sir Roderick Glossop before, of course, but only when I was with Honoria. And there is something about Honoria which makes almost anybody you meet in the same room seem sort of undersized and trivial by comparison. I had never realized till this moment what an extraordinarily formidable old bird he was. He had a pair of shaggy eyebrows which gave his eyes a piercing look, which was not at all the sort of thing a fellow wanted to encounter on an empty stomach. He was fairly tall and fairly broad, and he had the most enormous head, with practically no hair on it, which made it seem bigger and much more like the dome of St. Paul's. I suppose he must have taken about a 9 or something in hats. Shows what a rotten thing it is to let your brain develop too much.
"What ho, what ho, what ho!" I said, trying to strike the genial note, and then had a sudden feeling that that was just the sort of thing I had been warned not to say. Dashed difficult it is to start things going properly on an occasion like this. A fellow living in a London flat is so handicapped. I mean to say, if I had been the young squire greeting the visitor in the country, I could have said, "Welcome to Meadow Sweet Hall," or something zippy like that. It sounds silly to say, "Welcome to Number 6A, Crichton Mansions, Berkeley Street West."
"I am afraid I am a little late," he said, as we sat down. "I was detained at my club by Lord Alastair Hungerford, the Duke of Ramfurline's son. His Grace, he informed me, had exhibited a renewal of the symptoms which have been causing the family so much concern. I could not leave him immediately. Hence my unpunctuality, which I trust has not discommoded you."
"Oh, not at all. So the Duke is off his rocker, what?"
"The expression which you use is not precisely the one I should have employed myself with reference to the head of perhaps the noblest family in England, but there is no doubt that cerebral excitement does, as you suggest, exist in no small degree." He sighed as well as he could with his mouth full of cutlet. "A profession like mine is a great strain, a great strain."
"Must be.
Sometimes I am appalled at what I see around me." He stopped suddenly and sort of stiffened. "Do you keep a cat, Mr. Wooster?"
"Eh? What? Cat? No, no cat."
I was conscious of a distinct impression that I had heard a cat mewing either in the room or very near to where we are sitting.
"Probably a taxi or something in the street."
"I fear I do not follow you."
"I mean to say, taxi squawk, you know, rather like cats in a sort of way."
I had not observed the resemblance, he said rather coldly.
"Have some lemon squash," I said. The conversation seemed to be getting rather difficult.
"Thank you. Half a glassful, if I may." The hell brew appeared to buck him up, for he resumed in a slightly more pally manner. "I have a particular dislike for cats. But I was saying, oh yes, sometimes I am positively appalled at what I see around me. It is not only the cases which come under my professional notice, painful as many of those are, it is what I see as I go about London. Sometimes it seems to me that the whole world is mentally unbalanced. This very morning, for example, a most singular and distressing occurrence took place as I was driving from my house to the club. The day being clement,
I had instructed my chauffeur to open my landaulette, and I was leaning back, deriving no little pleasure from the sunshine, when our progress was arrested in the middle of the thoroughfare by one of those blocks in the traffic which are inevitable in so congested a system as that of London. I suppose I've been letting my mind wander a bit, for when he stopped and took a sip of lemon squash, I had a feeling that I was listening to a lecture and was expected to say something. "Hear, hear," I said. "I beg your pardon?" "Nothing, nothing. You were saying?" The vehicles proceeding in the opposite direction had also been temporarily arrested, but after a moment they were permitted to proceed. I had fallen into a meditation, when suddenly the most extraordinary thing took place. My hat was snatched abruptly from my head, and as I looked back, I perceived it being waved in a kind of feverish triumph from the interior of a taxicab, which, even as I looked, disappeared through a gap in the traffic and was lost to sight. I didn't laugh, but I distinctly heard a couple of my floating ribs part from their moorings under the strain. "It must have been meant for a practical joke," I said. "What?" This suggestion didn't seem to please the old boy. "I trust," he said, "I am not deficient in an appreciation of the humorous, but I confess that I am at a loss to detect anything akin to pleasantry in the outrage. The action was beyond all question that of a mentally unbalanced subject. These mental lesions may express themselves in almost any form. The Duke of Ramfurline, to whom I had occasion to allude just now, is under the impression—this is in the strictest confidence—that he is a canary, and his seizure today, which so perturbed Lord Alastair, was due to the fact that a careless footman had neglected to bring him his morning lump of sugar. Cases are common again of men waylaying women and cutting off portions of their hair. It is from a branch of this latter form of mania that I should be disposed to imagine that my assailant was suffering. I can only trust that he will be placed under proper control before he— Mr. Wooster, there is a cat close at hand. It is not in the street. The mewing appears to come from the adjoining room." This time I had to admit there was no doubt about it. There was a distinct sound of mewing coming from the next room. I punched the bell for Jeeves, who drifted in and stood waiting with an air of respectful devotion. "Sir?" "Oh, Jeeves," I said, "cats. What about it? Are there any cats in the flat?"
"Only the three in your bedroom, sir."
"What? Cats in his bedroom?" I heard Sir Roderick whisper in a kind of stricken way, and his eyes hit me amidships like a couple of bullets.
"What do you mean?" I said, "only the three in my bedroom." "The black one, the tabby, and the small lemon-colored animal, sir."
"What on earth?" I charged round the table in the direction of the door. Unfortunately, Sir Roderick had just decided to edge in that direction himself, with the result that we collided in the doorway with a good deal of force, and staggered out into the hall together. He came smartly out of the clinch and grabbed an umbrella from the rack. "Stand back!" he shouted, waving it overhead. "Stand back, sir! I am armed!" It seemed to me that the moment had come to be soothing. "Awfully sorry I barged into you," I said. "Wouldn't have had it happen for worlds. I was just dashing out to have a look into things." He appeared a trifle reassured, and lowered the umbrella. But just then the most frightful shindy started in the bedroom. It sounded as though all the cats in London, assisted by delegates from outlying suburbs, had got together to settle their differences once and for all—a sort of augmented orchestra of cats. "This noise is unendurable," yelled Sir Roderick. "I cannot hear myself speak."
"I fancy, sir," said Jeeves respectfully, "that the animals may have become somewhat exhilarated as the result of having discovered the fish under Mr. Wooster's bed."
The old boy tottered. "Fish! Did I hear you rightly?"
"Sir?"
"Did you say that there was a fish under Mr. Wooster's bed?"
"Yes, sir."
Sir Roderick gave a low moan and reached for his hat and stick.
"You aren't going," I said.
"Mr. Wooster, I am going. I prefer to spend my leisure time in less eccentric society." "But I say, Here, I must come with you. I'm sure the whole business can be explained. Jeeves, my hat.
Jeeves rallied round. I took the hat from him and shoved it on my head.
Good heavens!
Beastly shock it was. The belly thing had absolutely engulfed me, if you know what I mean. Even as I was putting it on, I got a sort of impression that it was a trifle roomy, and no sooner had I let go of it than it settled down over my ears like a kind of extinguisher.
I say, this isn't my hat.
It is my hat, said Sir Roderick in about the coldest, nastiest voice I'd ever heard. The hat which was stolen from me this morning as I drove in my car. But I suppose Napoleon or somebody like that would have been equal to the situation, but I'm bound to say it was too much for me. I just stood there goggling in a sort of coma, while the old boy lifted the hat off me and turned to Jeeves. "I should be glad, my man," he said, "if you would accompany me a few yards down the street. I wish to ask you some questions."
"Very good, sir."
"Here, but I say—" I began, but he left me standing. He stalked out, followed by Jeeves. And at that moment the row in the bedroom started again, louder than ever. I was about fed up with the whole thing. I mean, cats in your bedroom? A bit thick, what? I didn't know how the dickens they had got in, but I was jolly well resolved that they weren't going to stay picnicking there any longer. I flung open the door. I got a momentary flash of about 115 cats, of all sizes and colors, scrapping in the middle of the room, and then they all shot past me with a rush and out of the front door. And all that was left of the mob scene was the head of a whacking big fish, lying on the carpet and staring up at me in a rather austere sort of way, as if it wanted a written explanation and apology. There was something about the thing's expression which absolutely chilled me, and I withdrew on tiptoe and shut the door. And as I did so, I bumped into someone.
"Oh, sorry," he said.
I spun round. It was the pink-faced chappie, Lord something or other, the fellow I'd met with Claude and Eustace.
"I say," he said apologetically, "awfully sorry to bother you, but those weren't my cats I met just now legging it downstairs, were they? They looked like my cats."
"They came out of my bedroom."
"Then they were my cats," he said sadly. "Oh, dash it!
Did you put cats in my bedroom?"
"Your man—what's-his-name did. He rather decently said I could keep them there till my train went. I'd just come to fetch them. And now they've gone."
"Oh, well, it can't be helped, I suppose. I'll take the hat and the fish, anyway."
I was beginning to dislike this chappie.
"Did you put that bally fish there, too?"
"No, that was Eustace's. The hat was Claude's."
I sank limply into a chair.
"I say, you couldn't explain this, could you?" I said.
The chappie gazed at me in mild surprise.
"Why, don't you know all about it?
I say!" He blushed profusely.
"Why, if you don't know about it, I shouldn't wonder if the whole thing didn't seem rummy to you."
"Rummy is the word."
"It was for the Seekers, you know."
"The Seekers?"
"Rather a blood club, you know, up at Oxford, which your cousins and I are rather keen on getting into. You have to pinch something, you know, to get elected. Some sort of a souvenir, you know. A policeman's helmet, you know, or a door knocker or something, you know. The room's decorated with the things at the annual dinner, and everybody makes speeches and all that sort of thing. Rather jolly. Well, we wanted rather to make a sort of special effort and do the thing in style, if you understand, so we came up to London to see if we couldn't pick up something here that would be a bit out of the ordinary. And we had the most amazing luck right from the start. Your cousin Claude managed to collect a quite decent top hat out of a passing car, and your cousin Eustace got away with a really goodish salmon or something from Harrod's, and I snaffled three excellent cats all in the first hour. We were fearfully braced, I can tell you. And then the difficulty was to know where to park the things till our train went. You look so beastly conspicuous, you know, tooling about London with a fish and a lot of cats. And then Eustace remembered you, and we all came on here in a cab. You were out, but your man said it would be all right. When we met you, you were in such a hurry that we hadn't time to explain. "Well, I think I'll be taking the hat, if you don't mind."
"It's gone."
"Gone?" "The fellow you pinched it from happened to be the man who was lunching here. He took it away with him."
"Oh, I say! Poor old Claude will be upset. Well, how about the goodish salmon or something?"
"Would you care to view the remains?" He seemed all broken up when he saw the wreckage.
"I doubt if the committee would accept that," he said sadly. "There isn't a frightful lot of it left, what?"
"The cats ate the rest."
He sighed deeply.
"No cats, no fish, no hat. We've had all our trouble for nothing. I do call that hard. And on top of that, I say, I hate to ask you, but you couldn't lend me a tenner, could you?"
"A tenner? What for?"
"Well, the fact is, I've got to pop round and bail Claude and Eustace out. They've been arrested."
"Arrested?"
"Yes. You see, what with the excitement of collaring the hat and the salmon or something, added to the fact that we had a rather festive lunch, they got a bit above themselves, poor chaps, and tried to pinch a motor lorry. Silly, of course, because I don't see how they could have got the thing to Oxford and shown it to the committee. Still, there wasn't any reasoning with them, and when the driver started making a fuss, there was a bit of a mix-up, and Claude and Eustace are more or less languishing in Vine Street Police Station, till I pop round and bail them out. So if you could manage a tenner—"
"Oh, thanks, that's fearfully good of you. It would have been too bad to leave them there, what?
I mean, they're both such frightfully good chaps, you know. Everybody likes them up at Varsity. They're fearfully popular."
"I bet they are," I said.
When Jeeves came back, I was waiting for him on the mat. I wanted speech with the blighter.
"Well?" I said.
"Sir Roderick asked me a number of questions, sir, respecting your habits and mode of life, to which I replied guardedly."
"I don't care about that. What I want to know is, why didn't you explain the whole thing to him right at the start? A word from you would have put everything clear."
"Yes, sir."
"Now he's gone off thinking me a loony."
"I should not be surprised from his conversation with me, sir, if some such idea had not entered his head."
I was just starting in to speak when the telephone bell rang. Jeeves answered it.
"No, madam, Mr. Wooster is not in. No, madam, I do not know when he will return. No, madam, he left no message. Yes, madam, I will inform him."
He put back the receiver.
"Mrs. Gregson, sir."
"Aunt Agatha.
I have been expecting it. Ever since the luncheon party had blown out a fuse, her shadow had been hanging over me, so to speak."
"Does she know, already?"
"I gather that Sir Roderick has been speaking to her on the telephone, sir, and—"
"No wedding bells for me, what?"
Jeeves coughed.
"Mrs. Gregson did not actually confide in me, sir, but I fancy that some such thing may have occurred. She seemed decidedly agitated, sir."
"It's a rummy thing, but I've been so snooted by the old boy and the cats and the fish and the hat and the pink-faced chappie and all the rest of it that the bright sight simply hadn't occurred to me till now. By Jove, it was like a bally weight rolling off my chest. I gave a yelp of pure relief."
"Jeeves," I said, "I believe you worked the whole thing."
"Sir?"
"I believe you had the jolly old situation in hand right from the start."
"Well, sir, Spencer, Mrs. Gregson's butler, who inadvertently chanced to overhear something of your conversation when you were lunching at the house, did mention certain of the details to me. And I confess that, though it may be a liberty to say so, I entertained hopes that something might occur to prevent the match. I doubt if the young lady was entirely suitable to you, sir."
"And she would have shot you out on your ear 5 minutes after the ceremony."
"Yes, sir. Spencer informed me that she had expressed some such intention. Mrs. Gregson wishes you to call upon her immediately, sir."
"She does, eh? What do you advise, Jeeves?"
"I think a trip abroad might prove enjoyable, sir."
I shook my head.
"She'd come after me."
"Not if you went far enough afield, sir. There are excellent boats leaving every Wednesday and Saturday for New York."
"Jeeves," I said, "you are right as always. Book the tickets."
End of chapter 8. Chapter 9 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P. G. Woodhouse. Chapter 9. A Letter of Introduction. You know, the longer I live, the more clearly I see that half the trouble in this bally world is caused by the light-hearted and thoughtless way in which chappies dash off letters of introduction and hand them to other chappies to deliver to chappies of the third part. It's one of those things that make you wish you were living in the Stone Age. What I mean to say is, if a fellow in those days wanted to give anyone a letter of introduction, he had to spend a month or so carving it on a large-sized boulder, and then chances were that the other chappie got so sick of lugging the thing round in the hot sun that he dropped it after the first mile. But nowadays it's so easy to write letters of introduction that everybody does it without a second thought, with the result that some perfectly harmless cove like myself gets in the soup. Mark you, all the above is what you might call the result of my riper experience. I don't mind admitting that in the first blush of the thing, so to speak, when Jeeves told me, this would be about 3 weeks after I'd landed in America, that a blighter called Cyril Bessington Bessington had arrived, and I found that he had brought a letter of introduction to me from Aunt Agatha. Where was I? Oh, yes, I don't mind admitting, I was saying, that just at first I was rather bucked. You see, after the painful events which had resulted in my leaving England, I hadn't expected to get any sort of letter from Aunt Agatha which would pass the censor, so to speak. And it was a pleasant surprise to open this one and find it almost civil. Chilly, perhaps, in parts, but on the whole quite tolerably polite. I looked on the thing as a hopeful sign. Sort of olive branch, you know. Or do I mean orange blossom? What I'm getting at is that the fact that Aunt Agatha is writing to me without calling me names seemed more or less like a step in the direction of peace. And I was all for peace, and that right speedily. I'm not saying a word against New York, mind you. I liked the place, and was having quite a ripe time there. But the fact remains that a fellow who's been used to London all his life does get a trifle homesick on a foreign strand, and I wanted to pop back to the cozy old flat in Berkeley Street, which could only be done when Aunt Agatha had simmered down and got over the Glossop episode. I know that London is a biggish city, but believe me, it isn't half big enough for any fellow to live in with Aunt Agatha when she's after him with the old hatchet. And so, I'm bound to say, I looked on this chump Bassington Bassington, when he arrived, more or less as a dove of peace, and was all for him. He would seem, from contemporary accounts, to have blown in one morning at 7:45, that being the ghastly sort of hour they shoot you off the liner in New York. He was given the respectful raspberry by Jeeves, and told to try again about 3 hours later, when there would be a sporting chance of my having sprung from my bed with a glad cry to welcome another day and all that sort of thing. Which was rather decent of Jeeves, by the way, for it so happened that there was a slight estrangement, a touch of coldness, a bit of row, in other words, between us at the moment, because of some rather priceless purple socks which I was wearing against his wishes. And a lesser man might easily have snatched at the chance of getting back at me a bit by loosing Cyril into my bedchamber at a moment when I couldn't have stood a 2 minutes' conversation with my dearest pal. For until I've had my early cup of tea and have brooded on life for a bit absolutely undisturbed, I am not much of a lad for the merry chit-chat. So Jeeves very sportingly shot Cyril out into the crisp morning air, and didn't let me know of his existence till he brought his card in with the Bohea. "And what might all this be, Jeeves?" I said, giving the thing the glassy gaze. "The gentleman has arrived from England, I understand, sir. He called to see you earlier in the day." "Good Lord, Jeeves! You don't mean to say the day starts earlier than this?" "He desired me to say he would return later, sir." "I've never heard of him. Have you ever heard of him, Jeeves?" "I am familiar with the name Bassington Bassington, sir. There are three branches of the Bassington Bassington family. The Shropshire Bassington Bassingtons, the Hampshire Bassington Bassingtons, and the Kent Bassington Bassingtons."
"England seems pretty well stocked up with Bassington Bassingtons."
"Tolerably so, sir."
"No chance of a sudden shortage, I mean, what?"
"Presumably not, sir."
And what sort of a specimen is this one?
I could not say, sir, on such short acquaintance.
Will you give me a sporting 2-to-1, Jeeves, judging from what you have seen of him, that this chappie is not a blighter or an excrescence?
No, sir, I should not care to venture such a liberal odds.
I knew it. Well, the only thing that remains to be discovered is what kind of a blighter he is.
Time will tell, sir. The gentleman brought a letter for you, sir.
Oh, he did he? I said, and grasped the communication. And then I recognized the handwriting.
I say, Jeeves, this is from my Aunt Agatha.
Indeed, sir.
Don't dismiss it in that light way. Don't you see what this means? She says she wants me to look after this excrescence while he's in New York.
By Jove, Jeeves, if I only fawn on him a bit so that he sends back a favorable report to headquarters, I may yet be able to get back to England in time for Goodwood.
Now is certainly the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party, Jeeves. We must rally round and cosset this cove in no uncertain manner.
Yes, sir.
He isn't going to stay in New York long, I said, taking another look at the letter. He's headed for Washington. Going to give the nibs there the once-over, apparently, before taking a whirl at the diplomatic service. I should say that we can win this lad's esteem and affection with a lunch and a couple of dinners, what?
I fancy that would be entirely adequate, sir.
This is the jolliest thing that's happened since we left England. It looks to me as if the sun were breaking through the clouds.
Very possibly, sir.
He started to put out my things, and there was an awkward sort of silence.
Not those socks, Jeeves, I said, gulping a bit, but having a dash at the careless, off-hand tone.
Give me the purple ones.
I beg your pardon, sir.
Those jolly purple ones.
Very good, sir.
He lugged them out of the drawer as if he were a vegetarian fishing a caterpillar out of the salad. You could see that he was feeling deeply. Deuced painful and all that, this sort of thing, but a chappie has got to assert himself every now and then. Absolutely.
I was looking for Cyril to show up again any time after breakfast, but he didn't appear. So towards 1 o'clock I trickled out to the Lambs Club, where I had an appointment to feed the Wooster face with a cove of the name of Caffin I'd got pally with since my arrival. George Caffin, a fellow who wrote plays and what not. I'd made a lot of friends during my stay in New York, the city being crammed with bonhomous lads who one and all extended a welcoming hand to the stranger in their midst. Caffin was a bit late, but bobbed up finally, saying that he had been kept at a rehearsal of his new musical comedy, Ask Dad, and we started in. We had just reached for the coffee when the waiter came up and said that Jeeves wanted to see me. Jeeves was in the waiting room. He gave the socks one pained look as I came in, then averted his eyes.
"Mr. Bassington Bassington has just telephoned, sir."
"Oh?"
"Yes, sir."
"Where is he?"
"In prison, sir."
I reeled against the wallpaper. A nice thing to happen to Aunt Agatha's nominee on his first morning under my wing, I did not think.
"In prison?"
"Yes, sir. He said on the telephone that he had been arrested and would be glad if you would step round and bail him out."
"Arrested? What for?"
"He did not favor me with his confidence in that respect, sir."
"This is a bit thick, Jeeves."
"Precisely, sir."
I collected old George, who very decently volunteered to stagger along with me, and we hopped into a taxi. We sat around at the police station for a bit on a wooden bench in a sort of anteroom, and presently a policeman appeared, leading in Cyril.
"Hello, hello, hello," I said. "What?"
"My experience is that a fellow never really looks his best just after he's come out of a cell. When I was up at Oxford, I used to have a regular job bailing out a pal of mine who never failed to get pinched every boat race night, and he always looked like something that had been dug up by the roots. Cyril was in pretty much the same sort of shape. He had a black eye and a torn collar, and altogether was nothing to write home about, especially if one was writing to Aunt Agatha. He was a thin, tall chappie, with a lot of light hair and pale blue goggly eyes, which made him look like one of the rarer kinds of fish.
"I got your message," I said.
"Oh, are you Bertie Wooster?"
"Absolutely.
and this is my pal George Caffin. Writes plays and what not, don't you know?" We all shook hands, and the policeman, having retrieved a piece of chewing gum from the underside of a chair, where he had parked it against a rainy day, went off into a corner and began to contemplate the infinite. "This is a rotten country," said Cyril. "Oh, I don't know, you know, don't you know?" I said. "We do our best," said George. "Old George is an American," I explained. "Writes plays, don't you know, and what not." "Of course, I didn't invent the country," said George. "That was Columbus. But I shall be delighted to consider any improvements you may suggest and lay them before the proper authorities." "Well, why don't the policemen in New York dress properly?" George took a look at the chewing officer across the room. "I don't see anything missing," he said. "I mean to say, why don't they wear helmets like they do in London? Why do they look like postmen? It isn't fair on a fellow. Makes it dashed confusing. I was simply standing on the pavement looking at things when a fellow who looked like a postman prodded me in the ribs with a club. I didn't see why I should have postmen prodding me. Why the dickens should a fellow come 3,000 miles to be prodded by postmen?" "The point is well taken," said George. "What did you do?" "I gave him a shove, you know. I've got a frightfully hasty temper, you know. All the Bassingtons have got frightfully hasty tempers, don't you know? And then he biffed me in the eye and lugged me off to this beastly place." "I'll fix it, old son," I said. And I hauled out the bankroll and went off to open negotiations, leaving Cyril to talk to George. I don't mind admitting that I was a bit perturbed. There were furrows in the old brow, and I had a kind of foreboding feeling. As long as this chump stayed in New York, I was responsible for him. And he didn't give me the impression of being the species of cove a reasonable chappie would care to be responsible for more than about 3 minutes. I mused with a considerable amount of tensity over Cyril that night when I got home and Jeeves had brought me the final whiskey. I couldn't help feeling that this visit of his to America was going to be one of those times that try men's souls and what not. I hauled out Aunt Agatha's letter of introduction and reread it, and there was no getting away from the fact that she undoubtedly appeared to be somewhat wrapped up in this blighter and to consider it my mission in life to shield him from harm while on the premises. I was deuced thankful that he had taken such a liking for George Caffin, old George being a steady sort of cove. After I had got him out of his dungeon cell, he and old George had gone off together, as chummy as brothers, to watch the afternoon rehearsal of Ask Dad. There was some talk, I gathered, of their dining together. I felt pretty easy in my mind while George had his eye on him. I had got about as far as this in my meditations when Jeeves came in with a telegram. At least it wasn't a telegram, it was a cable, from Aunt Agatha, and this is what it said. "Has Cyril Bassington called yet? On no account introduce him into theatrical circles. Vitally important. Letter follows." I read it a couple of times. "This is rummy, Jeeves."
"Yes, sir."
"Very rummy, and dashed disturbing."
"Will there be anything further tonight, sir?"
Of course, if he was going to be as badly unsympathetic as that, there was nothing to be done. My idea had been to show him the cable and ask his advice. But if he was letting those purple socks rankle to that extent, the good old noblesse oblige of the Woosters couldn't lower itself to the extent of pleading with the man. Absolutely not. So I gave it a miss. "Nothing more, thanks."
"Good night, sir."
"Good night." He floated away, and I sat down to think the thing over. I had been directing the best efforts of the old bean to the problem for a matter of half an hour when there was a ring at the bell. I went to the door, and there was Cyril, looking pretty festive. "I'll come in for a bit, if I may," he said. "Got something rather priceless to tell you." He curveted past me into the sitting room, and when I got there, after shutting the front door, I found him reading Aunt Agatha's cable and giggling in a rummy sort of manner. Ought to have looked at this, I suppose. Caught sight of my name and read it without thinking. "I say, Wooster, old friend of my youth, this is rather funny. Do you mind if I have a drink? Thanks awfully, and all that sort of rot. Yes, it's rather funny, considering what I came to tell you.
jolly old Caffin has given me a small part in that musical comedy of his, Ask Dad. Only a bit, you know, but quite tolerably ripe. I'm feeling frightfully braced, don't you know?" He drank his drink and went on. He didn't seem to notice that I wasn't jumping about the room yapping with joy. "You know, I've always wanted to go on the stage, you know," he said. "But my jolly old governor wouldn't stick it at any price. Put the old Wachese down with a bang and turned bright purple whenever the subject was mentioned. That's the real reason I came over here, if you want to know. I knew there wasn't a chance of my being able to work the stage wheeze in London without somebody getting onto it and tipping off the governor, so I rather brainily sprang the scheme of popping over to Washington to broaden my mind. There's nobody to interfere on this side, you see, so I can go right ahead." I tried to reason with the poor chump. "But your governor will have to know sometime." "That'll be all right. I shall be the jolly old star by then, and he won't have a leg to stand on." "It seems to me he'll have one leg to stand on while he kicks me with the other." "Why, where do you come in? What have you got to do with it?" "I introduced you to George Caffin." "So you did, old top, so you did. I'd quite forgotten." "I ought to have thanked you before. Well, so long. There's an early rehearsal of Ask Dad tomorrow morning, and I must be toddling." "Rummy the thing should be called Ask Dad, when that's just what I'm not going to do. See what I mean, what? Well, pip-pip." "Toodaloo," I said sadly, and the blighter scudded off. I dived for the phone and called up George Caffin. "I say, George, what's all this about Cyril Bassington Bassington?"
"What about him?"
"He tells me you've given him a part in your show."
"Oh, yes, just a few lines."
"But I've just had 57 cables from home telling me on no account to let him go on the stage."
"I'm sorry, but Cyril is just the type I need for that part. He's simply got to be himself."
"It's pretty tough on me, George, old man. My Aunt Agatha sent this blighter over with a letter of introduction to me, and she will hold me responsible."
"She'll cut you out of her will?"
"It isn't a question of money. But, of course, you've never met my Aunt Agatha, so it's rather hard to explain. But she's a sort of human vampire bat, and she'll make things most fearfully unpleasant for me when I go back to England. She's the kind of woman who comes and rags you before breakfast, don't you know?"
"Well, don't go back to England, then. Stick here and become president."
"But, George, old top—"
"Good night."
"But I say, George, old man, you didn't get my last remark. It was good night. You idle rich may not need any sleep, but I've got to be bright and fresh in the morning. God bless you." I felt as if I hadn't a friend in the world. I was so jolly well worked up that I went and banged on Jeeves's door. It wasn't a thing I'd have cared to do as a rule, but it seemed to me that now was the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party, so to speak, and that it was up to Jeeves to rally round the young master, even if it broke up his beauty sleep. Jeeves emerged in a brown dressing gown.
"Sir?"
"Deuced sorry to wake you up, Jeeves, and what not, but all sorts of dashed disturbing things have been happening."
"I was not asleep. It is my practice, upon retiring, to read a few pages of some instructive book."
"That's good. What I mean to say is, if you've just finished exercising the old bean, it's probably in mid-season form for tackling problems. Jeeves, Mr. Bassington Bassington is going on the stage."
"Indeed, sir?"
"Ah, the thing doesn't hit you. You don't get it properly. Here's the point. All his family are most fearfully dead against his going on the stage. There's going to be no end of trouble if he isn't headed off. And what's worse, my Aunt Agatha will blame me, you see."
"I see, sir."
"Well, can't you think of some way of stopping him?"
"Not, I confess, at the moment, sir."
"Well, have a stab at it."
"I will give the matter my best consideration, sir. Will there be anything further tonight?"
"I hope not. I've had all I can stand already."
"Very good, sir."
He popped off. End of chapter 9.
Chapter 10 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P.G. Woodhouse. Chapter 10. Startling Dressiness of a Lift Attendant. The part which old George had written for the chump Cyril took up about 2 pages of typescript. But it might have been Hamlet, the way that poor misguided pinhead worked himself to the bone over it. I suppose if I heard him his lines once, I did it 12 times in the first couple of days. He seemed to think that my only feeling about the whole affair was one of enthusiastic admiration, and that he could rely on my support and sympathy. What with trying to imagine how Aunt Agatha was going to take this thing, and being woken up out of the dreamless in the small hours every other night to give my opinion of some new bit of business which Cyril had invented, I became more or less the good old shadow. And all the time Jeeves remained still pretty cold and distant about the purple socks. It's this sort of thing that ages a chappie, don't you know, and makes his youthful joie de vivre go a bit groggy at the knees. In the middle of it, Aunt Agatha's letter arrived. It took her about 6 pages to do justice to Cyril's father's feelings in regard to his going on the stage, and about 6 more to give me a kind of sketch of what she would say, think, and do if I didn't keep him clear of injurious influences while he was in America. The letter came by the afternoon mail, and left me with a pretty firm conviction that it wasn't a thing I ought to keep to myself. I didn't even wait to ring the bell. I whizzed for the kitchen, bleeding for Jeeves, and butted into the middle of a regular tea party of sorts. Seated at the table were a depressed-looking cove who might have been a valet or something, and a boy in a Norfolk suit. The valet chappie was drinking a whiskey and soda, and the boy was being tolerably rough with some jam and cake. "Oh, I say, Jeeves," I said, "sorry to interrupt the feast of reason and flow of soul and so forth, but—" At this juncture the small boy's eye hit me like a bullet and stopped me in my tracks. It was one of those cold, clammy, accusing sort of eyes, the kind that makes you reach up and see if your tie is straight. And he looked at me as if I were some sort of unnecessary product which Cuthbert the Cat had brought in after a ramble among the local ash-cans. He was a stoutish infant with a lot of freckles and a good deal of jam on his face. "Hello, hello, hello," I said. "What?" There didn't seem much else to say. The stripling stared at me in a nasty sort of way through the jam. He may have loved me at first sight, but the impression he gave me was that he didn't think a lot of me and wasn't betting much that I would improve a great deal on acquaintance. I had a kind of feeling that I was about as popular with him as a cold Welsh rabbit. "What's your name?" he asked. "My name? Oh, Wooster, don't you know, and what not?" "My pop's richer than you are." That seemed to be all about me. The child, having said his say, started in on the jam again. I turned to Jeeves. "I say, Jeeves, can you spare a moment? I want to show you something."
"Very good, sir."
We toddled into the sitting-room. "Who is your little friend, Sidney the Sunbeam, Jeeves?"
"The young gentleman, sir."
"It's a loose way of describing him, but I know what you mean."
"I trust I was not taking a liberty in entertaining him, sir?"
"Not a bit. If that's your idea of a large afternoon, go ahead."
"I happened to meet the young gentleman taking a walk with his father's valet, sir, whom I used to know somewhat intimately in London, and I venture to invite them both to join me here."
"Well, never mind about him, Jeeves. Read this letter."
He gave it the up and down.
"Very disturbing, sir," was all he could find to say.
"What are we going to do about it?"
"Time may provide a solution, sir."
"On the other hand, it mayn't, what?"
"Extremely true, sir." We'd got as far as this when there was a ring at the door. Jeeves shimmered off, and Cyril blew in, full of good cheer and blitheringness.
"I say, Wooster, old thing," he said, "I want your advice. You know this jolly old part of mine? How ought I to dress it? What I mean is, the first act scene is laid in an hotel of sorts, at about 3 in the afternoon. What ought I to wear, do you think?"
I wasn't feeling fit for a discussion of gent suitings.
"You'd better consult Jeeves," I said.
"A hot and by no means unripe idea. Where is he?"
Gone back to the kitchen, I suppose.
I'll smite the good old bell, shall I? Yes? No?
Right-o. Jeeves poured silently in.
"Oh, I say, Jeeves," began Cyril. "I just wanted to have a syllable or two with you. It's this way.
Hello, who's this?"
I then perceived that the stout stripling had trickled into the room after Jeeves. He was standing near the door looking at Cyril as if his worst fears had been realized. There was a bit of a silence. The child remained there, drinking Cyril in for about half a minute. Then he gave his verdict.
"Fish face."
"Eh? What?" said Cyril. The child, who had evidently been taught at his mother's knee to speak the truth, made his meaning a trifle clearer.
"You've a face like a fish."
He spoke as if Cyril was more to be pitied than censured, which, I am bound to say, I thought rather decent and broad-minded of him. I don't mind admitting that whenever I looked at Cyril's face, I always had a feeling that he couldn't have got that way without its being mostly his own fault. I found myself warming to this child. Absolutely, don't you know? I liked his conversation. It seemed to take Cyril a moment or two really to grasp the thing, and then you could hear the blood of the Bassington Bassingtons begin to sizzle.
"Well, I'm dashed," he said. "I'm dashed if I'm not."
"I wouldn't have a face like that,"
proceeded the child with a good deal of earnestness.
"Not if you gave me $1 million."
He thought for a moment, then corrected himself.
$2 million, he added.
Just what occurred then I couldn't exactly say, but the next few minutes were a bit exciting. I take it that Cyril must have made a dive for the infant. Anyway, the air seemed pretty well congested with arms and legs and things. Something bumped into the Worcester waistcoat just about the third button, and I collapsed onto the settee and rather lost interest in things for the moment. When I had unscrambled myself, I found that Jeeves and the child had retired, and Cyril was standing in the middle of the room snorting a bit.
"Who's that frightful little brute, Worcester?"
"I don't know. I never saw him before today." I gave him a couple of tolerably juicy buffets before he legged it.
"I say, Worcester, that kid said a dashed odd thing.
He yelled out something about Jeeves promising him $1 if he called me, what he said. It sounded pretty unlikely to me.
What would Jeeves do that for?
It struck me as rummy, too.
Where would be the sense of it?
That's what I can't see. I mean to say, it's nothing to Jeeves what sort of a face you have."
"No," said Cyril.
He spoke a little coldly, I fancied. I don't know why. "Well, I'll be popping. Toodaloo. Pip, pip." It must have been about a week after this rummy little episode that George Caffin called me up and asked me if I would care to go and see a run-through of his show. Ask Dad, it seemed, was to open out of town in Schenectady on the following Monday, and this was to be a sort of preliminary dress rehearsal. Preliminary dress rehearsal, old George explained, was the same as a regular dress rehearsal, inasmuch as it was apt to look like nothing on earth, and last into the small hours, but more exciting because they wouldn't be timing the piece, and consequently all the blighters who on these occasions let their angry passions rise would have plenty of scope for interruptions, with the result that a pleasant time would be had by all. The thing was billed to start at 8 o'clock, so I rolled up at 10:15, so as not to have too long to wait before they began. The dress parade was still going on. George was on the stage, talking to a cove in shirt sleeves and an absolutely round chappie with big spectacles and a practically hairless dome. I had seen George with the latter merchant once or twice at the club, and I knew that he was Blumenfeld, the manager. I waved to George and slid into a seat at the back of the house, so as to be out of the way when the fighting started. Presently George hopped down off the stage and came and joined me, and fairly soon after that the curtain went down. The chappie at the piano whacked out a well-meant bar or two, and the curtain went up again. I can't quite recall what the plot of Ask Dad was about, but I do know that it seemed able to jog along all right without much help from Cyril. I was rather puzzled at first. What I mean is,
through brooding on Cyril and hearing him in his part and listening to his views on what ought and what ought not to be done, I suppose I had got a sort of impression rooted in the old bean that he was pretty well the backbone of the show, and that the rest of the company didn't do much except go on and fill in when he happened to be off the stage. I sat there for nearly half an hour waiting for him to make his entrance, until I suddenly discovered that he had been on from the start. He was, in fact, the rummy-looking plug-ugly who was now leaning against a potted palm a couple of feet from the OP side, trying to appear intelligent while the heroine sang a song about love being like something which for the moment has slipped my memory. After the second refrain, he began to dance in the company with a dozen other equally weird birds. A painful spectacle for one who could see a vision of Aunt Agatha reaching for the hatchet and old Bassington Bassington Sr. putting on his strongest pair of hobnailed boots. Absolutely. The dance had just finished, and Cyril and his pals had shuffled off into the wings when a voice spoke from the darkness on my right. "Pop!" Old Blumenfield clapped his hands, and the hero, who had just been about to get the next line off his diaphragm, cheesed it. I peered into the shadows. Who should it be but Jeeves's little playmate with the freckles? He was now strolling down the aisle with his hands in his pockets, as if the place belonged to him. An air of respectful attention seemed to pervade the building. "Pop," said the stripling, "that number's no good." Old Blumenfield beamed over his shoulder. "Don't you like it, darling? It gives me a pain." "You're dead right. You want something zippy there, something with a bit of jazz to it." "Quite right, my boy. I'll make a note of it. All right, go on." I turned to George, who was muttering to himself in rather an overwrought way. "I say, George, old man, who the dickens is that kid?" Old George groaned a bit hollowly, as if things were a trifle thick. "I didn't know he had crawled in. It's Blumenfield's son. Now we're going to have a Hades of a time." "Does he always run things like this?"
"Always."
"But why does old Blumenfield listen to him?"
"Nobody seems to know. It may be pure fatherly love, or he may regard him as a mascot.
My own idea is that he thinks the kid has exactly the amount of intelligence of the average member of the audience, and that what makes a hit with him will please the general public, while, conversely, what he doesn't like will be too rotten for anyone. The kid is a pest, a wart, and a pot of poison, and should be strangled." The rehearsal went on. The hero got off his line. There was a slight outburst of frightfulness between the stage manager and a voice named Bill that came from somewhere near the roof, the subject under discussion being where the devil Bill's ambers were at that particular juncture. Then things went on again until the moment arrived for Cyril's big scene. I was still a trifle hazy about the plot, but I had got on to the fact that Cyril was some sort of an English peer who had come over to America doubtless for the best reasons. So far he had only had two lines to say. One was, "Oh, I say," and the other was, "Yes, by Jove." But I seemed to recollect, from hearing him read his part, that pretty soon he was due rather to spread himself. I sat back in my chair and waited for him to bob up. He bobbed up about 5 minutes later. Things had got a bit stormy by that time. The voice and the stage director had had another of their love feasts. This time, something to do with why Bill's blues weren't on the job or something. And almost as soon as that was over, there was a bit of unpleasantness because a flower pot fell off a window ledge and nearly brained the hero. The atmosphere was consequently more or less hotted up when Cyril, who had been hanging about at the back of the stage, breezed down center and toed the mark for his most substantial chunk of entertainment. The heroine had been saying something, I forget what, and all the chorus, with Cyril at their head, had begun to surge round her in the restless sort of way those chappies always do when there's a number coming along. Cyril's first line was, "Oh, I say, you know, you mustn't say that, really." And it seemed to me he passed it over the larynx with a goodish deal of vim and je ne sais quoi.
But, by Jove, before the heroine had time for the comeback, our little friend with the freckles had risen to lodge a protest.
"Pop!"
"Yes, darling?"
"That one's no good."
"Which one, darling?"
"The one with a face like a fish."
"But they all have faces like fish, darling." The child seemed to see the justice of this objection. He became more definite.
"The ugly one."
"Which ugly one? That one?" said old Blumenfield, pointing to Cyril.
"Yep, he's rotten."
"I thought so myself."
"He's a pill."
"You're dead right, my boy. I've noticed it for some time." Cyril had been gaping a bit while these few remarks were in progress. He now shot down to the footlights. Even from where I was sitting, I could see that these harsh words had hit the old Bassington family pride a frightful wallop. He started to get pink in the ears, and then in the nose, and then in the cheeks, till in about a quarter of a minute he looked pretty much like an explosion in a tomato cannery on a sunset evening.
"What the deuce do you mean?"
"What the deuce do you mean?" shouted old Blumenfield. "Don't yell at me across the footlights! I've a dash good mind to come down and spank that little brute."
"What?"
"A dashed good mind." Old Blumenfield swelled up like a pumped-up tire. He got rounder than ever.
"See here, mister, I don't know your darn name. My name's Bassington, and the jolly old Bassingtons— I mean the Bassingtons aren't accustomed—"
Old Blumenfield told him in a few brief words pretty much what he thought of the Bassingtons and what they weren't accustomed to. The whole strength of the company rallied round to enjoy his remarks. You could see them jutting out from the wings and protruding from behind trees.
"You got to work good for my pop," said the stout child,
waggling his head reprovingly at Cyril.
"I don't want any bally cheek from you," said Cyril, gurgling a bit.
"What's that?" barked old Blumenfield. "Do you understand that this boy is my son?"
"Yes, I do," said Cyril.
"And you both have my sympathy."
"You're fired!"
bellowed old Blumenfield, swelling a good bit more.
"Get out of my theater!"
About 10:30 next morning, just after I had finished lubricating the good old interior with a soothing cup of oolong, Jeeves filtered into my bedroom and said that Cyril was waiting to see me in the sitting room.
"How does he look, Jeeves?"
"Sir?"
"What does Mr. Bassington look like?"
"It is hardly my place, sir, to criticize the facial peculiarities of your friends."
"I don't mean that. I mean, does he appear peeved and what not?"
"Not noticeably, sir. His manner is tranquil."
"That's rum."
"Sir?"
"Nothing. Show him in, will you?"
I'm bound to say I had expected to see Cyril showing a few more traces of last night's battle. I was looking for a bit of the overwrought soul and the quivering ganglions, if you know what I mean. He seemed pretty ordinary and quite fairly cheerful.
"Hello, Wooster, old thing."
"Cheero."
"I just looked in to say goodbye."
"Goodbye?"
"Yes, I'm off to Washington in an hour." He sat down on the bed. "You know, Wooster, old top," he went on, "I've been thinking it over, and really it doesn't seem quite fair to the jolly old governor, my going on the stage and so forth. What do you think?"
"I see what you mean."
"I mean to say, he sent me over here to broaden my jolly old mind in words to that effect, don't you know, and I can't help thinking it would be a bit of a jar for the old boy if I gave him the bird and went on the stage instead. I don't know if you understand me, but what I mean to say is, it's a sort of question of conscience."
"Can you leave the show without upsetting everything?"
"Oh, that's all right. I've explained everything to old Blumenfield, and he quite sees my position. Of course, he's sorry to lose me, said he didn't see how he could fill my place and all that sort of thing. But, after all, even if it does land him in a bit of a hole, I think I'm right in resigning my part, don't you?"
"Oh, absolutely."
"I thought you'd agree with me. Well, I ought to be shifting. Awfully glad to have seen something of you and all that sort of rot. Pip, pip."
Toodaloo.
He sallied forth, having told all those bally lies with the clear, blue, pop-eyed gaze of a young child. I rang for Jeeves. You know, ever since last night, I have been exercising the old bean to some extent, and a good deal of light had dawned upon me.
Jeeves,
sir,
did you put that pie-faced infant up to ballyragging Mr. Bassington Bassington?
Sir?
Oh, you know what I mean. Did you tell him to get Mr. Bassington Bassington sacked from the Ask Dad Company?
I would not take such a liberty, sir.
He started to put out my clothes.
It is possible that young Master Blumenfield may have gathered from casual remarks of mine that I did not consider the stage altogether a suitable sphere for Mr. Bassington Bassington.
I say, Jeeves, you know, you're a bit of a marvel.
I endeavour to give satisfaction, sir.
And I'm frightfully obliged, if you know what I mean. Aunt Agatha would have had 16 or 17 fits if you hadn't headed him off.
I fancy there might have been some little friction and unpleasantness, sir. I am laying out the blue suit with the thin red stripe, sir. I fancy the effect will be pleasing.
It's a rummy thing, but I'd finished breakfast and gone out and got as far as the lift before I remembered what it was that I had meant to do to reward Jeeves for his really sporting behaviour in this matter of the chump Cyril. It cut me to the heart to do it, but I had decided to give him his way and let those purple socks pass out of my life. After all, there are times when a cove must make sacrifices. I was just going to nip back and break the glad news to him when the lift came up, so I thought I would leave it till I got home. The colored chappie in charge of the lift looked at me as I hopped in, with a good deal of quiet devotion and what not.
"I wish to thank you, sir," he said, "for your kindness."
"Eh, what?"
"Mr. Jeeves done give me them purple socks, as you told him."
"Thank you very much, sir."
I looked down. The blighter was a blaze of mauve from the ankle bone southward. I don't know when I've seen anything so dressy.
"Oh, ah, not at all. Righto. Glad you like them," I said.
"Well, I mean to say what?"
"Absolutely." End of chapter 10.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.